And welcome to the ABF Fellow CLE program. This morning, the program is entitled Safeguarding Democracy. My name is Sandra Chan, and it is my honor to be serving as the president of the American Bar Foundation. Before I introduce our moderator for today's panel discussion, I want to take just a moment to say a few words about the important work of the ABF. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, the ABF is a research institute founded more than 70 years ago. The ABF brings together a community of leading scholars conducting long-term empirical and interdisciplinary research dedicated to helping us better understand where law and society intersect. This important work wouldn't be possible without the support of many of you who are fellows of the ABF. Your donations as fellows help to sustain the ABF's mission, and we are truly grateful for your generosity. Fellows also serve as ambassadors, helping disseminate the research in courtrooms, classrooms, and communities. In order to change policy that affects our justice system, we must rely upon solid data that is based on in-depth and independent research. That is exactly the kind of research the ABF conducts. Thank you again for your support, your leadership, and for being here. I'm grateful to our moderator, Deborah Enix Ross, for being with us today and her work in facilitating today's discussion. Before Deborah introduces our other panelists, I just want to say a few words about Deborah. Deborah is a distinguished leader in international law and dispute resolution. She currently serves as senior advisor for global engagement in the International Dispute Group and as a member of the ESG group in her firm, Debevoise and Plimpton. Okay? Maybe it's anyway, sorry about that. Deborah served as the 2023-2024 president of the American Bar Association and is a past chair of the ABA Center for Human Rights, as well as the section of international law. She built a trailblazing career that includes senior roles at the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva, Pricewaterhouse, and the International Chamber of Commerce. Widely recognized for her commitment to justice, equity, and the rule of law, she has been named to the Forbes list of America's top 200 lawyers. Her decades of service across global legal institutions and her dedication to human rights have made her a true force for change in the legal profession. Deborah has been a fellow of the American Bar Foundation since 1997 and is currently a patron fellow. She also serves as a board member of the American Bar Endowment, which has been a primary funder of our work for each of the last 70 years. That makes us doubly grateful for her support of the ABF. Deborah, I'm so honored to welcome you here and have you moderate our panel today.
Thank you. That was a very generous, overly generous introduction, but I appreciate it. So, good morning, everyone. Jeff knows. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
There we go. We're all awake now. I've had my tea and you've had your coffee. I also want to thank you for being here for what promises to be a timely and essential conversation. And the emphasis is on conversation. We'll have some presentations, but it's really meant to be a way for us to think together about this topic of safeguarding democracy. As members of the legal community, we understand deeply that democracy is not self-executing. It depends on the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, and the vigilance of legal professionals like us. We are the ones who are stewards of constitutional norms. I don't have to tell you that we're witnessing an increasing strain on democratic institutions, attacks on the legal framework, and expanded use of executive authority to reshape policy outside of the legislative process. Now, let me stop here and say this is not a political discussion. We are really trying to understand the fundamentals of what has happened in the past, where we are now, and how we can go forward. So if it sounds political, I'm trying very hard not to be political. And I think as many of you will remember, when I was privileged to be ABA president, I talked about civics and civility and collaboration. So if you'll give me that bit of grace as I do these opening remarks. So lawyers have long played a dual role in both defending democratic norms and challenging laws or actions that violate them. From litigating voting rights cases to advising state agencies, our profession is embedded in the infrastructure of democracy. So this panel today, we will discuss how legal mechanisms, how statutes and court decisions and executive orders are shaping the current landscape of American democracy. And we'll examine how these tools have been used in the past and what our concerns may be now. We have a really, really good panel, and you come to hear them, not me. So let me start by introducing Aziz Hook, who is the Frank and Bernice J. Professor at the University of Chicago Law School and Associate Professor of Sociology. His many books include How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, which was written in 2018 with Tom Ginsburg, The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies, that was written in 2021, and The Rule of Law, A Very Short Introduction, written in 2024. So his scholarship is published in leading law, social science, political science, and criminology journals. He also writes for, I love this, Politico, but we're not being politics here. He writes for the London Review of Books and many other general interest publications, and I think that's important because as lawyers, we need to learn how to speak to non-lawyers and how to make sure we're getting the messages across. Before teaching, he represented civil liberties claimants with the Brennan Center for Justice and worked for the International Crisis Group in Afghanistan, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. He was also a law clerk for Judge Robert D. Sack in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court of the United States. So Aziz is very well equipped to start us off, and we thought we might look at a history of democratic backsliding. Aziz.
Thank you so much, Deborah, and I'm just making sure that I'm timely. Do I need to turn this on? No. Well, thank you very much to the Barr Foundation for arranging this timely discussion, to Deborah for that very kind introduction. What I thought I'd do in my remarks today is two things. The first thing is to offer a definition by way of benchmark of sorts of how I understand the rule of law. I think that's valuable because I realized myself a couple of years ago that I was using the phrase rule of law, but I was not thinking about what I understood by it. My writing of the rule of law, A Very Short Introduction, was for me a way of trying to get to grips with what I ought to mean or what I could mean by that phrase. And so I'd like to put on the table a sense of what the rule of law as a phrase means. And then the second thing I want to do is to identify what I think are the two analytically distinct ways in which the rule of law comes under strain in moments of democratic backsliding. And by doing that, what I hope to do is to identify the connections, and I think there are plural, between, on the one hand, the concept of the rule of law, and on the other hand, the system-wide value of democracy. Okay, so let me start, though, with a definition, which I think for many of us seems, it's not entirely clear why we need to start off with a definition of the rule of law. We use the phrase all the time, and we think we know what we mean by it. But I do think stepping back a moment and reflecting upon the term's history gives us some additional purchase and clarity. So if you look back to when the phrase was coined, It is not all that old a phrase. The first time it is employed as a term of art is in 1883 in the work of Albert Van Dicey, who is an English constitutional scholar, writing on the English Constitution. He wasn't making a general claim about what all legal systems had to have. Now, Dicey did draw upon older traditions. He did draw, for example, in work in the classical tradition, in particular Aristotle, on the idea of the value of written and settled law. He did draw upon ideas from England's tumultuous 17th century, in particular the work of John Locke, and the risk of state power that was untrammeled. But Dicey transformed those earlier sources and refined them into something new, which he understood as one of the two distinctive pillars of English constitutionalism, along with parliamentary supremacy. Now, I'll get to his definition in a second, but from that effort to identify something distinctive, not about law, but about English law, in the 20th century, you had a flowering, an efflorescence of other thinkers and writers who took Dicey's phrase and employed it across all sorts of different contexts. So probably the most important inheritors of Dicey's phrase were, on the one hand, social liberals like Lon Fuller, who wrote a book called The Morality of Law. Many of you will have encountered Fuller's Case of the Spelunkian Explorers when you were in law school. And on the other hand, the Austrian neoliberal school of thinkers, in particular Friedrich Hayek, who takes up the idea of rule of law and pushes it in a direction where it connects to the marketplace. After World War II, this rich texture of discourse about the rule of law is plucked from the academy and employed in the world. In particular, it's employed by the World Bank, but it's also taken up by rulers and by political leaders, not just in the Anglosphere, not just in the United States, Canada, and the UK, but very far afield. So, for example, in China, in 1982, the Chinese Constitution is amended to include a rough translation of the phrase the rule of law into the Chinese constitution. So you have, across the 20th century, this remarkable globalization where a phrase that was used initially to describe something distinctive about the English constitution is understood as something that characterizes all legal constitutions and even something that a relatively authoritarian state like China could aspire toward. So across all of those divergent and dissonant meanings, is there a common thread? Is there something that holds these things together? Or is the rule of law just kind of happy talk that we use to describe, you know, something that we like about a legal system? Well, I do think that there's something coherent in the rule of law. I do think that there's a core to the tradition, and I think that coming back and grasping that core is really helpful. The place that I find useful to start there is the work of a man called John Finnis, who teaches at the University of Oxford. Finnis says, look, the term the rule of law describes a legal system, a whole bunch of institutions, including courts, legislatures, written laws, a legal system that is in good working order. So the rule of law is an explicitly evaluative term. It's an explicitly moral term. It's saying that something is meeting an aspiration. But what kind of aspiration? Well, if you look across the tradition all the way back to Dicey, I think you have two basic claims about what the rule of law means. The first is that the legal system constrains those in power. That is the idea of the rule of law that is embedded in 1883 in Dicey's work. And then second, that the rule of law describes a situation in which the law provides guidance for those who are outside of the state, seeking to understand how the state will use its authority. That's a version of the rule of law that's associated with Fuller. So just let me give you one example of one of those two definitions. Dicey, right back in 1883, says, look, the core of the rule of law is when, if you're going to be subject to some kind of penalty by the state, if you're going to lose something, it has to be done in the ordinary legal manner before the ordinary courts of the land. Right? There has to be a process, and the process has to be the ordinary legal process. Moreover, Dicey says, if there is an ordinary law of the land, it has to apply in exactly the same way to everybody, whether they are holders of state power or people on the receiving end of state power. So embedded all the way back in 1883 is this idea that the law speaks to everybody, and it constrains. It constrains the state when it takes people, takes things away from you, and it constrains the state equally. It puts you, the citizen, the ordinary person, on a level pegging with the state, right? Fuller has the idea, conversely or differently, that the law provides guidance, that you can look at the books that comprise the law. You can read off from the books what is going to happen. And that prediction from the books is one that actually cashes out as how state power is used. Okay, so you have these two concepts of the rule of law, the constraint function and the guidance function. These lie at the heart, I think, of the tradition. I think they're also present in different ways in Hayek's work and in at least some of the work that's internationalized the rule of law after that. Well, how are those two ideas at stake today, and how do they pertain to or grip on the question of democratic backsliding? I think the way to approach that is to observe that across the last 20 years, as Tom Ginsberg and I wrote in 2018, there is a measurable decrease in the quality and the number of democracies around the world. And looking across those backsliding democracies, and backsliding can be defined in technical terms using measures of democratic quality that institutions like Polity or the Economist Intelligence Unit employ. Looking across those democratic backsliding democracies, you see a distinctive pattern through which law is deployed as an instrument in ways that unravel the constraint function. So if you look in the last 20 years, there is a distinctive way in which law is employed against constraint. If you look in the last 6 months, particularly in the United States, I think you see a way in which it is not just the constraint function that is imperiled, it is also the guidance function of law that is cast into doubt. And by thinking about the ways that those two functions, constraint and guidance, are put under pressure, I think we can get a better grip on the relationship between, on the one hand, this concept of the rule of law, and on the other hand, the value of democracy. So let me play that out by saying a little bit about how I would describe what played out across backsliding democracies in the first two decades of the 20th century, and then I'll say something about how I would describe what is distinctive that's occurred in the United States in the last 6 months. So if one looks across the pool of countries that lost the institutional circumstances for meaningful democratic competition through elections in the first two decades of the 20th century, what one sees is the persistent use of law to unravel those institutions of state that are employed to constrain those in power, in particular those who gain power in elections and then have executive office. So across countries like Poland, Hungary, Venezuela, Russia to a certain extent, although Russia's democracy never quite congeals in the 1990s, and so I think it's an edge case in terms of democratic backsliding. Pretty much the same set of tactics reemerge time and time again. The same set of state institutions are assaulted using legal techniques. Often, the first target in a process of backsliding are judges and the courts. The courts are either packed, or they are purged of judges who were unfavorable to a new regime. Parallel or somewhat later to that, you'll see the same kind of efforts to use law to reform, but actually to align and politicize the state bureaucracy. For example, in places like Hungary, you saw independent bodies that were supposed to regulate the media being taken over by the government and then being employed for entrenchment of the Fidesz regime. And then, further, you see the direct weaponization of the law in respect to electoral competition and in respect to the quality of the public sphere. A couple of examples of this in Russia, the Putin government has made very creative and extensive use of libel under the Medvedev regime, or under the Medvedev the brief period where Medvedev was leader. Libel was recriminalized; it had been decriminalized, and it was made a criminal offense again. And then that criminal offense of libel was used against political opponents. In Turkey, which is, I think it has been a rich case study of democratic backsliding, the mayor of Istanbul, who is the leader of the political opposition, was recently arrested and expeditiously prosecuted and convicted on fraud charges in a way that makes it impossible for him to run in the presidential election next year, an election which, at least according to many polls, he would be likely to prevail against the incumbent AK Party leadership. Right. So those are a couple of different ways in which law is weaponized, is instrumentalized in ways that collapse the constraints upon the use of state power. And in the 2018 book that I wrote with my colleague Tom Ginsberg, our project, we thought, was trying to explain to people that law could be a double-edged sword. Law is an instrument. It can be used in many different ways. And you need to be careful and attentive to the effects of a particular tool in a given context. So that's law as constraint collapsing. What I think you've seen in the United States in the last 6 months, however, I think is somewhat different. I do think you've seen some of the tools that one observed in other backsliding democracies play out in the United States, and I have every expectation that the quality of democracy as measured in policy, et cetera, will go down substantially in the next year or two. But I think you have a different set of tools being used, ones that that undermine both the constraint and the guidance function of law. Back in February, I wrote a short article for a non-academic publication, not political, The Atlantic, where I argued that we should think about some of the tools that we see in the United States through the lens of a really just, for me, a very inspiring lawyer and thinker called Ernst Frankel. Frankel was a Jewish lawyer. Born at the beginning of the 20th century, lives in Germany, is formerly a Jewish lawyer, told that he's not allowed to practice in 1933, immediately after the emergency decree. But because he had served in World War I, because he'd served on the front, there was thanks to Paul von Hindenburg, there was an exception in the law. You could appeal and say, I served at the front, therefore I'm still allowed to practice. Frankel stays in Germany and practices as a lawyer, largely representing socialists, largely representing people who worked for the Confessing Church, between 1933 and 1938. Amazingly, he leaves Germany about 3 weeks before Kristallnacht. So he gets out just in time, goes to London, where he tries to get a position in the expatriate community, doesn't get it, and then ends up in Chicago, gets a JD at my law school in 1941, and while he's doing that, writes a book called The Dual State. And The Dual State is an account of how law operated in his experience in the early 1930s in Germany. And the core idea of The Dual State, the core idea that Frankel's book, which was, I think, has been unfairly neglected for many, many years, The core idea is that it is possible for a state to bifurcate and to create two zones or regions, one in which the law applies and one in which power is exercised lawlessly. And the project of his book, The Dual State, was to say, hey, don't think about law as collapsing immediately. Think about the possibility that the state can build a lawless zone into the existing structures of the state. You can have a duality in the state. I think that Frankl's ideas are useful for thinking about this present moment. And I think there are instances in which you can see something like, not exactly like, something like the dual state emerging in the United States. And I think when that happens, what gets undermined is not just the constraint function, but the guidance function that law, and in particular constitutional law, is meant to supply. Let me give you a couple of very quick examples, although I think that these are things that if you've been reading the newspaper, you know. And so I don't want to tread over ground that is familiar. So I would identify two mechanisms that one can see in the last 6 months in the United States as instruments whereby there's something like a dual state emerging. I don't think I use these phrases in The Atlantic, but I would call them colloquially the kill switch and turning kindness into a knife. The kill switch is when the government acts in a way that directly negates the force of law or the force of a court order. I think that actually the most vivid example of that for people in this room are the executive orders concerning law firms. The executive orders concerning law firms are just flatly on their face unconstitutional. They're violations of the core principle of the First Amendment, which is a rule against viewpoint discrimination on the part of the government. And yet, they worked. I think if you look at the pattern of non-compliance with court orders, not just with respect to immigration matters, but with respect to spending matters, you again see the law being treated as an option that you can just switch off. That creates a zone, or the possibility, that the government can act against somebody in a way where the law just doesn't count. The second, and I think more subtle mechanism, is this, that the federal government in the United States operates largely, not through direct regulation, but through cooperative relationships. It's built up an infrastructure of cooperative relationships with both states and with private entities by dint of its position fiscally, right? Since after the 16th Amendment, the federal government has been in a position to collect far more tax in relation to the several states. And it's used that taxing authority to build up an infrastructural state through cooperative relationships. And in those cooperative relationships, in things like Medicaid and things like the federal funding of universities for science and for innovation, entities on the other end of the relationship develop dependencies. They develop expectations of the continued flow of that funding, because those entities, the universities or the states, they have clients. They have individuals who depend on them, students, people who are getting their services. And if the federal government threatens to turn off that stream of funding, conditioning it on actions that are unrelated to the legal basis for the funding, which, by the way, is both unconstitutional and unlawful, right? Suddenly those entities are in a bind. So I think the best example of this is what happened in January, February in the state of Maine. The state of Maine has a particular policy with respect to when kids can participate in sports events if they're trans, right? Whatever that policy is. The Department of Agriculture funds a program that supports hot meals for kids in Maine schools. Maine is one of the poorest states in the nation. There are lots of kids in Maine who depend upon this federal program for school meals. For meal, it's their only meal in the day. The federal government said, we're going to shut off this program unless you, the state of Maine, change your policy on trans kids in sports. Right, whatever you think of the issue of trans kids in sports, and I recognize there are complex questions, right? First of all, that threat's unlawful. But second, notice what it does. It says to the state, if you don't do what we want you to do, what we will do is we will hurt these people who are your literally vulnerable wards. So it is using the threat of harm to a third party to, blackmail may be too strong a word, but it's not that too strong a word, to alter the behavior unlawfully of the state. And I think if you look across interactions with the states, in the education context, the interactions with the universities, the interactions actually with federal employees, like the lawyers in the Southern District of New York, who were asked to drop the Eric Adams prosecution, you see exactly this pattern, where some ongoing relationship is weaponized in ways that turn a productive relationship into a source of vulnerability, into a source of extraction of goods. And both of those tools, the kill switch and turning kindness into a knife, I think, are instruments that in some sense negate the force of law. They take us into a world where what's written in the books is not a dependable guide to what the government can do. And so I would suggest that by thinking about the original, not the original understanding, but the core understandings of the rule of law, right, these guidance and constraints function, we actually get a grip on the central questions of democratic backsliding and the tools that are employed across the board to achieve it. Thanks.
Thank you. Sobering. But you, as you can see, this is why we wanted Aziz to start to give us the landscape and to understand historically. Historically. As I say, not hysterically, but historically, what happens in backsliding democracies. So, and there will be time for questions. As I said, it will be a conversation. So write down your thoughts or questions, and we'll collect them at the end. But now we're going to turn to David. So Professor David Dreisen is the 13th university professor ever appointed at Syracuse University. His research focuses on constitutional law, environmental law, and law and economics. He filled the distinguished Fulbright Chair in Environmental Law and Economics at the University of Ottawa in 2022. His most recent book, The Specter of Dictatorship, Judicial Enabling of Presidential Power, examines how heads of states wield executive power to undermine democracies. Professor Dreisen has also written The Economic Dynamics of Law, The Economic Dynamics of Environmental Law, which won the Lytton Keith Caldwell Award, and the textbook Environmental Law, A Conceptual and Pragmatic Approach. He has also published two edited volumes, Economic Thought and U.S. Climate Change Policy, and Beyond Environmental Law, Policy Proposals for a Better Future. So he could really talk to us about environmental law and really give us a really great understanding. But that's not what he's going to do today. We've asked him to elaborate on this. The specter of dictatorship and judicial enabling of presidential power, and talk about these use of executive orders. So thank you, David.
Thank you, and I'm really thrilled to be here, partly because of the work that Deborah and others, I imagine, this room have done to have the ABA stand up to the rule of law. And it's extremely important work, and you know, one of the huge questions is what can we do about all this, which I'm not going to address. I'm just going to explain what's going on. So, yeah, I'm going to look at this in terms of the role of presidential power in undoing the rule of law and democracy, borrowing on the framework from the specter of dictatorship, judicial enabling of presidential power. And what I did in that book is I looked at democratic backsliding, especially in Turkey, Hungary, and Poland, with a goal of understanding how presidential power might, or abuse of it, might affect democracy in the U.S. and how that relates to jurisprudence. And so the book reaches two principal conclusions. The first is that the unitary executive provides a pathway to autocracy. And the second and less surprising conclusion is that abuse of emergency powers can accelerate democratic decline. So I'm going to look at first the centralization problem. All executive branches in working democracies have bastions of independence. It has been found that in order to have a rule of law where you rationally implement law reasonably consistently over time, you have to have an independent civil service. And you also see in functioning democracies that prosecution services have some degree of independence, because a rule of law means, in part, I think the implications of Aziz's explanation of what it is that prosecutors must decide whom to prosecute under a principle of equality, where it's based on evidence, not on the political affiliations of people. And election commissions, again, a working order requires that the elections be run not for the benefit of the ruling party, but with an eye toward fairness to all parties. And the same thing with media regulators. The media regulators are always independent, so far as I know, in working democracies, because you can't have content-based decisions about regulation, at least not political content-based decisions. Now, what you saw in Poland and Hungary and Turkey is they all started out with some version of this kind of independence. And then when an autocrat was elected, he and his party went about unraveling those things and concentrating power over these entities and others in the head of state. And once that was done, what you see is prosecution becomes in part a means to attack members of the opposition party. On the other hand, the regime protects corrupt supporters from prosecution. Election commissions are used to tilt the electoral playing field, not to assure elections fairness. And the media authorities are used to undermine independent media. So the Supreme Court has taken the position, however, that the United States Constitution requires this autocratic structure that has emerged as democracies decline. That is what they call a unitary executive. And what the unitary executive is the president's personal control, not the law's control, but the president's control over the executive branch of government. And it's been manifested in rulings insisting that in some, at least in some cases, and broadening number of cases, the president, it's not sufficient to say to the president, you can remove officials who don't properly implement the law. You must be able to remove, that removal authority must be unfettered, which implies that it can be used arbitrarily. Now, once a president has arbitrary removal power, he can remove officials for obeying court orders, for honoring the law, and for respecting individual rights. And that is what is going on now. So I want to talk a little bit about some particular examples of how the emergence of the unitary executive has undermined the rule of law. And by the way, thereby undermined important checks on presidential power and the separation of powers. So a key power of Congress is the spending power. And Congress, with the presidents in the past, established law which tries to prevent waste, fraud, and abuse by creating offices of inspectors general. And the inspectors general have constrained powers. They can't just take away funding, but they ferret out waste, fraud, and abuse, report it to Congress, take other measures. So Trump promptly abuses his executive power to fire these independent real guardians of fraud and creates DOGE, thereby usurping another congressional power, the power to structure government, and puts at its head Elon Musk. And they proceed to cut out funding for programs they don't like, usurping a key function of Congress. Now, they then go on to use funding in the manner Aziz described to start undermining independence. And I would add the sort of the elements of civil society and of the structure of the government that ensure the protection of rights. So the Supreme Court tells us that federalism is a key protection of rights. It is insisted on an anti-commandeering doctrine, which says that part of that protection is that the federal government cannot force elected officials to carry out federal programs, such as mass deportation programs. And that doctrine limited Trump's effort to dragoon local officials into deportation in the first term. So now what he's doing, and he did some of this in the first term, is he's threatening to cut off funding to state and local governments that won't cooperate in the mass deportation program, thereby weakening this fundamental protection of individual liberty. And then he's cutting off funding from universities, which is an attack on the independence of an institution that long serves as a bastion of independent thought. As you saw in Hungary and Turkey and many other countries that are sliding to authoritarianism, we've had an attack on the civil service with many mass firings and pressures of people to resign, the same thing we saw in Hungary and Turkey. And some of this is justified very explicitly by unitary executive function, especially silo law, where the president is taking the position that members of the civil service who participate in policymaking may not have for-cause removal protection. That protection should be stripped, which is building on dicta in the silo law decision. And then you have an attack on independent agencies. So we also have the traditions I describe as vital to democracy, that is our Federal Election Commission, our Federal Communication Commissions are independent agencies. And so Trump goes after the concept of independent agencies and this core thing that we see in working democracies by firing the commissioners from the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board to set up test cases. So he violates the constraints on removal of those officials, and then the government argues that those constraints are unconstitutional. The Supreme Court may well accept that argument, and if it does, it'll have undermined the FEC and the FCC as well, and the Federal Reserve Board, although they're likely to resist the logical implications of the principle being advanced. So you have that. And then with respect to the independence of prosecutors, our independence of prosecutors in the federal government stems primarily from an informal constitutional norm dating back to the founding of the Republic, which is that presidents don't meddle in decisions about whom to prosecute and investigate. Now, this constitutional custom was so strong that when President Nixon violated it, he was forced out of office by a bipartisan coalition. So that's how that works. And so the Supreme Court undermined this longstanding norm of constitutional of independence of prosecutors in Trump versus United States. Now that was the case in which the Supreme Court held that the president cannot be prosecuted for criminal use of his official powers. But in the course of that case, it also said that the president may confer with the Department of Justice about investigations, and indeed suggested that the exercise of prosecutorial authority is a fundamental presidential power, which it never has been in the history of the Republic, and thereby undermining the independence of prosecutors. And Trump is implementing this principle by firing Justice Department officials who obey court orders, insist on candor before tribunals, and not politicizing prosecutorial power. He's also evading another constraint, which in my opinion, the constraint exists, the fraudulence of the unitary executive theory. That is, the Appointments Clause teaches us that the president does not have sole control over the executive branch of government, because he can't appoint the principal officers of the government without the advice and consent of the Senate. He cannot choose the top officials of the government. And so that suggests that we're supposed to have a law of duty, not a law of presidential populism. So the the president then, all the, so at this moment, none of the district attorneys have been approved by the Senate, because he hasn't nominated anybody who he could get through the Senate. That is a fair, just prosecutor. He has unilaterally put in place, evaded the constraint, and put in district attorneys throughout the country unilaterally. So at this moment, the chief prosecutors in the United States have been chosen by the president, probably for political loyalty, and the stage is thus set, the history I've been examining suggests, for the kind of political prosecution that Trump has suggested he has in the offing. Now, so you know, the point is that the unitary executive theory provides a pathway to autocracy, and Trump is marching down it. Emergency powers. So Hungary, Turkey, Poland, and Nazi Germany all used emergency powers, abused them to tear down democracy. Justice Jackson's opinion in Youngstown notes the key role abuse of emergency powers played in destroying the Weimar Republic. Turkey is maybe the most potent recent example where there was a coup, a real emergency in Turkey, but Erdogan not only put down the coup, but he went on to use it as an excuse to rid the government offices of any vestige of independence and oppositional support. Now, the problem in the United States is that the Supreme Court has shown a marked tendency to defer to presidents' assertion of emergencies or national security justifications for actions. And the key example of that in the first term was Trump versus Hawaii, when the government instituted travel bans that were motivated clearly by a religious animus, but they did offer a propped up national security justification, and the court allowed the national security justification to trump the individual rights protections for religious freedom and the First Amendment. So that's an example of that. So for Trump, everything is emergency, and I must say I haven't done a thorough study of all of the uses of emergency powers by all autocrats, but in things I've seen, I've rarely seen just the pervasiveness and number of invocations of emergency powers. I have trouble thinking of a policy area where Trump hasn't declared some emergency to justify unilateral action. Now, a prime example, and this, I'm gonna tie this a little bit to Aziz's idea of guidance, which is not something I had planned, but I think it's worth making. So he starts out by saying, drug smuggling is not just a chronic problem, it's an emergency, and by the way, it's an invasion of the United States. And Canada is not doing enough about it, so we're gonna put tariffs as an emergency measure on Canada. And then he goes further and says, well, the balance of payments, that's an emergency. Most economists will tell you, I think all economists, that this is not an emergency, this is a benefit. That is, if you're bringing in, you're paying more for imports than you're earning in exports, that means your consumers are getting a bargain. And so it's not a problem. And even the title of the executive order suggests that it's persistent, which means it's not an emergency. So sure enough, the Court of Claims and perhaps the Federal Circuit soon seem to be recognizing this is not an emergency that can justify this, but these rulings have been stayed because the Supreme Court is constantly interfering with early judicial orders to preserve the status quo pending the adjudication of these questions. So, but the point I wanted to add to this is say, this is not just the usurpation of, one of the things this shows is that when you start getting into states of emergency power, you undermine the guidance function of law. Because if you have regular law, it's hard to change tariffs. You have to have a justification, a structure, and very specific reasons. But once, if it becomes an emergency power, then it can be changed at all the time, and businesses don't have any certainty, they don't know what was going on. So from my environmental cast, you know, one thing that businesses need to consider is regulation may be irksome and troubling, but at least it tells you what the rules are. Once that's gone, you have personalist control, and then the guidance function is undermined. And then he's declared an energy emergency to justify deregulation and support for fossil fuels at a time when the United States is the leading exporter of oil and natural gas, which it still is, and an alien invasion by supposedly aliens being sent by, or gangsters being sent here by Venezuela's government to try to justify mass deportation under the Alien Enemies Act. Okay, but I'm at the conclusion, my timer tells me I should be. So the unitary executive has provided a pathway to autocracy, and the abuse of emergency powers hastens the slide to autocracy.
Thank you. And let me apologize, because I really should have finished the rest of your biography, because this is also impressive. So David is he joined Syracuse University College of Law faculty in 1995. He was a visiting scholar at Harvard Law School, a visiting professor at the Buckman School of Law in Tel Aviv, the distinguished summer scholar at Vermont Law School, and a visiting professor at the University of Michigan Law School. He holds a Juris Doctorate degree from Yale Law School, and he served as attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council Air and Energy Program before entering academia. So I just wanted to make sure that we got all of that on the record. We are dealing with someone who, well, both of them, as you heard, are really thoughtful. For me, I'm sitting here thinking it's a bit sobering. It's good to know how we got where we are. And in some ways, is that a portent of where we're going? And if we know that, are there things that we in the legal profession can and should be doing now? So I think if you'll ponder that for a moment, I'm going to also have these questions. So I hope I can read it. Do we want me to read the name of the person or just the question?
Sure.
Okay. Does that say Eric? Is there an Eric? Yes, Eric Larson. Oh, okay. Wait. I was like Minnesota OFDA.
OFDA.
Okay. I was like OFDA. Okay. To deter or disincentivize a no rule of law zone, what tools are available to the courts when that branch seems to be the only check? Do you want to read? Let's see it.
So what can the courts do when that's the only check?
Yeah.
Well, let me just start with a general observation, which is that the district court is district courts are the primary remaining check on presidential power. The congressional check, which is supposed to be the most important one, is probably dead. And the Supreme Court is largely an enabler of autocracy, although occasionally does rule against Trump on things. So that's sort of where we are. In terms of the tools, I mean, I think one of the tools is to refer attorneys who violate their duties to the court and participate in disobeying court orders to bar associations. The other one is to jail people under the contempt power. Now, the problem with that is the president controls the marshal service, so he might have to enlist state officials in carrying out federal orders voluntarily, I suppose. But it's very difficult. And so some of the academics are commenting on the current moment and speculating about, you know, what is the Supreme Court doing in this moment? It seems to be undermining the district courts, is that perhaps they see a different strategy, that is that the federal courts cannot win a held-on battle with Trump, and so they're trying to husband things by avoiding direct confrontation, but sort of finessing this and try to get forward. So that's a debate that's going on, because historically, going back to Marbury versus Madison, when courts sense that their orders are not going to be obeyed, they have strategies to avoid straightforward applications of the law that might cause disobedience.
Yeah, I think I would just elaborate on that last point and maybe offer another parallel to Ernst Frankel's experience. So Frankel in 33 and 34 writes about being able to go into particularly the regional courts, the lender courts in Germany, like the Prussian High Court, and get relief for even not Jewish clients. He was actually quite careful not to represent people who were Jewish because it was so difficult to win in those cases. But he could win in cases involving the church and involving unions. And what he describes is that over the 4 or 5 years of his practice, that becomes more and more difficult because the courts, anticipating the exercise of effectively raw political power in ways that negated their position, would draw back further and further and would try and anticipatorily comply with what the regime at the time wanted. And so the dynamic of trying to preserve some measure of judicial authority turns out to be, at least in the experience of that Frankl describes, self-defeating. Because anticipating that you're going to lose your authority or lose face, lose legitimacy, as a court, creates a powerful spur to the executive to keep pushing the boundary. And then at some point, you don't have all that much authority left. So I think from the perspective of the courts, it's actually a lose-lose situation. Either they're put in the position where, as Judge Boasberg was, you issue an order and it's just not complied with, or you attempt to enforce, or you withdraw, and by withdrawing you incentivize more such behavior. And I think I can recognize and describe that dynamic. But I don't have an answer to, well, how do you get past it? I don't think anyone does.
Not what we wanted to hear, but that's okay. Because here's this one. So what is the solution to counter and reverse the democratic backsliding that you've described?
Is Democrats taking back the House
sufficient? Well, that's assuming there are going to be elections, because there are some of us who are worried. That's another question to put for you. But is Democrats taking back the House sufficient? How to deal with the Supreme Court? We've just talked about deference to the president. Is there anything that can be done about this?
That's a small question. Small question. I think the question is really how the rule of law is. Upon what foundation does the rule of law rest? And I don't think that there's a simple answer to that question. I think that the rule of law, as the framing of the question implies, rests upon not just institutional foundations about the proper operation of courts, bar associations, disciplinary proceedings, ethical rules, etc. All of those, I think, are important and vital, but also political foundations. It rests upon the notion that there are costs to the misuse of state authority, particularly in ways that either impinge upon people's constitutional rights or are forms of unlawful self-entrenchment. And in the United States, not that long ago, as the Nixon case demonstrates, there were political costs to the misuse of state authority for the purpose of entrenching a person or a party in power. And we're in a position or a moment where it's not clear there are such costs. The question of how we move from that equilibrium back to the equilibrium of the 1970s, politically, I don't think is a question of just winning elections. I think it's a question of And now I'm going to sound like a politician, and I really apologize. It's a question of values. It's a question of the set of ethical beliefs that people have and the things that are perceived generally as important, which I think those are values that emerge through a back and forth between political elites and the general public. I will at that point disclaim expertise. You know, I am, like you guys, a lawyer. I don't know how to do politics. And so I can recognize and describe the nature of a political problem or a problem in the political sphere, but I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, I'd add just a little bit, which is, I mean, the big question now is whether there will be fair elections for the midterms. And, you know, that's been another crippling move for democracy, is the declaration that blatantly partisan gerrymandering is a political question that the courts will not enter into, thereby clearing the way for manipulation that played a role, by the way, in Hungary's entrenchment and other places. It's hard to predict. So if you have a Democratic House, there will be some resistance, there will be some oversight. And the question, and this is why I want to cite Aziz's work here, that, you know, there's sort of unpredictable political effects of resistance. So you get, on the one hand, it might not have any effect at all because Trump is perfectly willing to ignore law and court orders. On the other hand, it's possible that and you saw this in Colombia, as he's pointed out, where, you know, a court ruled against the violation of term limits by the president, and in effect that led to the demise of the democracy. And so it's possible that resistance could, you know, provide a political opportunity by an institution like the House, could provide some kind of political opening. And the other point, that this comes from my book, is that you do have to understand it in terms of an interaction between institutions and people. So we don't think of it this way, but a number of us scholars do, but most people, we did not have democracy at all in the South after Reconstruction was defeated. I mean, the black population was like a majority or half, and they couldn't vote. So there was no democracy. There's much more impaired democracy than we have in Hungary or Poland, or these other cases that we look at as autocracy. And the way that changed is pretty consistent Supreme Court for voting rights, which didn't work for a long time, but it gave strength to political movements that over time undid these autocracies. Mm-hmm. So there's an interaction, it can be quite slow, between the resistance of institutions and the politics. And then one final point from Poland. You know, in Poland, the autocratic party piece lost after one term, and you got the Civic Platform won. But they're finding it difficult to undo the institutional supports for autocracy, because these guys still have their support, you know, in the courts and then in other places. And how do you remove them without undoing the principle of judicial independence? And so Polish legal scholars are, you know, grappling with that kind of problem.
So here's a different question, but I think following that vein. Thoughts on why Congress gave up its Article II spending power? And do you have thoughts on why the Senate gave up its appointment clause duty to ensure competence?
Well, that's difficult to answer. For some reason, I think the Republicans have been fearful of taking on Trump for a variety of reasons. One is the threat of primaries. The other is threats of physical violence. And, you know, Liz Cheney reports that the Republicans were thinking about voting to remove Trump after the January 6th attack, received death threats on their families and themselves. And so they're not willing to support the institutions very often. They support Trump. And that frequently happens. And when you in autocracies, that the ruling party, you see this as a pattern you saw in Poland, Hungary, and Turkey as well, that the ruling party becomes a completely subservient to the chief executive. They follow what he does. And this is something Jackson noted as a problem in the Youngstown decision, that the president can exercise authority that is extra constitutional in a way over the legislature through this sort of personal loyalty mechanism. And if that goes too far, then the institutional independence is undermined. So that seems to be what's going on.
Just to add to that point, it's worth remembering that all of the participants in the January 6th insurrection were pardoned. Mm-hmm. And the pardons of those 1,000-plus people don't just have an effect upon their behavior. You know, as we all know, law has deterrence effects. And so when the deterrent effect with respect to political violence is eliminated using the pardon power, in expectation, there will be more political violence. And it's one of the interesting things, I think, one of the things I think that is sort of, I think, pregnant in this moment is the fact that having through, having the pardon power being employed as a de facto invitation to further political violence, exactly what form will that take? Right, I actually don't think that that's clear, and it's not clear to me whether it would be focused around the midterms or whether it would be focused around a presidential election. I was actually a little surprised that there wasn't more violence around some of the immigration protests, more counter-violence around the immigration protests in places like Los Angeles. But it's very hard for me to see why you're not going to see at some point political violence, because the ecosystem of institutions exists. My political science colleague at Chicago, Robert Pate, has written a lot about this and done empirical work mapping these parastatal institutions. And the structure of incentives exists for political violence. So I think to the extent that you want to blame people for just being partisan, I think it's really important to remember that there's this background concern for people and their families that is, it's really a credible worry.
Aviana says, what role do you see or can universities play in pushing back against the administration?
Well, it's tricky because one of the things is, I think, getting a little beyond my expertise here, my political instincts are that you need solidarity and concerted action, like you saw with the ABA, with a lot of disparate interests here, but everybody agrees we should have a rule of law. But what you're seeing instead is some institutions are resisting, others are negotiating, and then the question becomes, the negotiated deals, that's just an invitation to get more. And so the independence is getting undermined. So that's a big problem. And some universities are just trying to lay low and stay below the radar, and others are employing litigation, and then some are trying to cut deals. And I'm not an expert in how you navigate this, but it's a very difficult problem.
Yeah, I would just point to one provision in the Columbia deal that I think is an example of the sort of thing that universities should not agree to, mm-hmm. which is a provision that permits a person appointed by the government to authorize or not authorize hiring. I think once a university outsources its decisions about who to appoint to faculty to an agent of the government, the university has lost its capacity or its right to assert itself as a body which is focused upon the production of knowledge rather than the reproduction of authority and power.
This is getting more sober each time with each question. But we're going to end, I promise you, I got some upbeat. Here's a question. Ray, environmental protection and policy, what are the next significant threats beyond enhanced gas and oil exploration?
What are the threats?
Yes.
Beyond the...
Sorry.
Well, I mean, the Trump administration is dismantling all of the funding for wind energy for renewables. It is undermining the growth of electric vehicles in the United States. It is undermining all actions to try to address the climate crisis. And the result of that, we're in a very severe crisis. I mean, if all the government, none of the governments in the world have been ambitious enough about this, that's sort of the consensus of climate experts, that we're in a moment of crisis that's going to get worse and worse and worse. And the United States is the second largest source of emissions and the largest historical source of emissions, isn't doing anything, is actively undermining efforts to do even economic things, like remove to go to renewable energy, then it'll be really hard to adequately address climate change, not only in the U.S., but in other countries, because other countries are looking to us and saying, well, what's the point if the U.S. is AWOL? It'll also have a pretty devastating effect on markets. I was in Brazil recently, and just about everybody owns Chinese electric cars, which are very good now, very cheap. And so our auto industry is not competing with them because we're not letting them into the country with these high tariffs. The result of that is the U.S. auto manufacturers are not going to be competitive outside of the United States. And so you're going to have a shrinking of a potential export market, destruction of the reality is, I've always been a fan of government regulation, but what's been driving climate policy in recent years has not been government regulation, much to, I thought, the fantasy of the right's proven true. That is, market forces have moved forward environmental relations because in the electric utility space, at least, the price of renewables is dropping below fossil fuels. So if they do anything, if they follow the cheapest thing, they end up moving away from coal and gas anyway. And you start undoing those market forces, and it becomes very, very hard. And they currently favor it. So it's the disruption of markets and the disruption of regulation and the disruption of funding together make it almost impossible to make progress.
I just want to add one thing to what David said. I've been writing a little bit about geopolitical competition over technology regulation. Yeah. And as you all know, there is competition over who is going to be have primacy with respect to particularly new AI technologies. But it turns out that if you look down the technological stack, right, what matters is not just who has the fanciest LLM, is it DeepSeek or OpenAI, but who has access to the underlying technologies of production that are necessary for the creation of computational technologies. And the two most important inputs are the chips and the materials that go into the chips, where China is in some fashion disadvantaged because it doesn't have fabs, but in some fashion, is advantaged because it's a principal supplier of rare earth materials. But the other big input is energy and the ways that energy is captured and stored. And the most important sort of technological frontier in that regard, as I understand this from a colleague in U of Chicago who's in physics, Shirley Meng, who's doing some pioneering work on this, is batteries. And particularly batteries for electric vehicles, and batteries that are being innovated over with respect to renewables, it will be a critical technology, not just for transportation, but, for example, for military purposes. And so if you kneecap your renewables industry, you are not just kneecapping Tesla, the irony of that, right? You are kneecapping your military capacities too, because there are material elements of modern military performance that rely upon the transmission of energy through the sort of the projection of you can't project military power unless you have the energy on which to run it, and it turns out that battery technologies are going to be one of the key elements of that, and the United States at least is falling now increasingly behind on batteries. One of the fascinating things about sort of what's unfolding in the environmental space is that it's having these I think not. I don't think, certainly the government doesn't realize it. These knock-on effects, which are going to have geostrategic implications, not today, but 5 or 10 years from now, you'll see these things really cash out.
So thinking about backsliding democracies, a couple of questions or observations. Are there any examples of a tipping point that brought them back more towards what we would describe as democratic principles or rule of law? And I ask because I think from what we're discussing, the U.S. is on the sliding side, but we need to understand, are there ways to tip it back towards more positive aspects? And are there any examples that we can look to, or is this something we're going to have to think separately because we're so unique in what we're facing?
No, there are lots of examples. I give you two particular guides. So my colleague Tom Ginsberg and I wrote a paper 2019 called Democracies Near Misses, where we used policy data and we looked at, well, are there instances in which the quality of a democracy goes down, touches the point at which, by convention, you move from a democracy to a competitive authoritarian regime, and then goes back up.
Yes.
And we found three in the 20th century. So David mentioned one, which was Colombia, where there was the Uribe wanted to use term limits or eliminate term limits to eliminate democracy. There's a case in Sri Lanka and there's a case in Latvia. And what was important was an interaction of both elites and popular movements. And so you had, to echo something David said, you had both elite pushback and popular movement pushback. And you do see movements back into democracy. Right, that's one class of cases. The other class of cases, which don't come up in our data because for reasons of sort of how we were modeling a near miss, are instances in which you've had long-standing autocracies and you've moved from autocracy back to democracy. And so the sort of the quintessential political science examples of that are Spain and Portugal in the 1970s,
right,
which move from military dictatorships to, both Spain and Portugal are very, very robust democracies by the early 1980s. And the other set of examples are in the Southern Cone, where you again have dictatorships, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, and you move from dictatorship, which is actually really, really violent, right? There's a marvelous movie that I think is on Netflix, I'm Still Here, about political violence in Brazil and what it does to the families of those who are disappeared. It was well worth watching. Those are regimes in which you have an enormous amount of political violence, and you come out the other end, and there are people who are, you know, they have lost their family members, and they're still willing to put themselves out there and risk their lives, their professional standing on standing up for democracy and the rule of law. So, both of these sets of cases, I think, ought to give, I've been very pessimistic until this point, but I think that there are lots of examples, if you look out in the world, where people have pulled things back from the edge with respect to democracy, and, you know, even when democracy has gone over the edge, as it did in the Southern Cone, as it did in Spain and Portugal, people at great personal cost sometimes have stood up for the values that they believe in, and sometimes the values that their loved ones have been sacrificed upon.
Yeah, I think that, I'm happy that there are examples, like modern examples, where you pull back, we've come back from the brink, and I think for us as lawyers, we're going to be a part of that conversation and a part of making sure that we are, I guess, speaking, when you mentioned, you said the elites and the populace pulled together. And I think what we're seeing sometimes in our society are these great divides, but this is actually a moment where we can all pull together. Last night I was talking to someone who identifies as conservative, like ultra, and said it's important for the ABA to survive as a bar association. It's important for us as a legal profession to pull together. It doesn't matter where we are politically, but this is sort of a fundamental aspect of our profession and then also in our society. So let me, there's one last question. Will the Supreme Court indulge the president's ability to define terms such as emergency, or will they assert the right to find the best definition of the term under
the life of rights. I can say something. So it's interesting that the question of emergency powers, I think, is likely to come to the Supreme Court from the Federal Circuit in respect to the challenge brought by the challenge was initially brought by it's a Florida importer of certain goods, but in the background is Professor Philip Hamburger's organization, which was responsible for pushing the litigation that terminated Chevron deference last year. And in the litigation that is challenging the tariffs, where the challengers prevailed in the Court of First Instance, which is called the Court of Claims, and where, as David said, the oral argument before the Federal Circuit, was it last week?
Yeah.
The government lawyers had a really hard time. And it did not, at least you can never tell, as you will know from oral arguments, what's going to happen. But it really didn't seem as if the government was going to prevail on that. Now, that doesn't predict what's going to happen in the Supreme Court. But it is the case that you don't need a constitutional ruling for the tariffs to be invalidated. You don't need a ruling with respect to whether or not there is an emergency. There are a plurality of arguments with respect to the textual structure of IEEPA, pursuant to which the government would lose. And of all of the cases where the facts, I think, disfavor the government, the tariff case, I think, is almost the worst case for the government. With respect to emergency powers. Why is it the worst case? Because there are headlines every day where it is clear that, for example, the imposition of 50% tariffs against Brazil is not being done for the reasons that are enumerated in the executive order. The tariffs on Canada, even the tariffs on India, which are putatively with respect to pass-through energy sales from Russia, which arguably is a national security matter, but it's not the national security matter that is identified in the emergency decree that is required to unlock IEEPA powers. So of all of the emergencies, you know, the southern border, the energy emergency, what have you, the tariff case is the one where the government's own very, very public behavior stands at a very far and really hard to ignore, remove from the textual framework for the exercise of those powers. I'm sure the court could find a way to uphold it, but it is, I think, the hardest case for the government to win with respect to emergency powers. So it's really interesting that that's the kind of first case it's not precisely the first case. You can think about the Enemy Aliens Act as the first case. But it might be the first big case of emergency powers to hit the court. And it's not the one that if I was the government's lawyer, I would favor.
But that's during logical times, and we are living in curious times now. So we shall see. But I appreciate the candor and the sobering discussion of what we've seen in other jurisdictions and other countries. There's the expression to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And we've seen examples of how far it can go, but we've also seen examples of people, of countries coming back and reclaiming democracy. So I think for us, it remains that we have to, in our individual capacities and collectively, stand up for the rule of law, stand up for democratic institutions, and especially stand up for the independence of our judiciary. Because I think when the history of this period is written, the real heroes are going to be the judges who issued rulings, even if they think they might not be adhered to, but they looked at the law, applied the law fairly, and issued the rulings. Of course, they need lawyers to bring those cases, but it's the judges, I think, that are really standing up. So all of us, we can go back in our daily lives and do what we can to support democracy in our communities in all the ways that we can. So thank you very much for this conversation, and thank you all for being here. And if you've got ideas that we can be doing within the ABA or in the ABF, please let us know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I would like to remind you to please fill out your evaluation, if you don't mind. And we also, the thumb drives at your seats contain the materials from today. And lastly, if you are from New York, you need to get scanned out so you can get the CLE credit. Okay, thank you. Natalie will scan you in and out. She's got you. Deborah.